It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Since the 1990s, the U.S. has seen a dramatic rise in deaths classified as accidental. The death toll from unintentional injuries in the country is now over 200,000 a year, according to the CDC's latest confirmed numbers, making it the third most likely way to die in the United States. For people aged 1 through 44, these incidents are the number one cause of death. Our next guest says we're in a modern accident epidemic, but it doesn't have to be this way. In her book, There Are No Accidents, she says we need to rethink these kinds of injuries and deaths and tackle the underlying causes behind them. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work or live in a place where there seem to be a lot of what you'd describe as accidents? Have you ever experienced one of these incidents on the job? Have you worked in an unsafe workplace? Has OSHA ever visited a workplace where you worked? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jesse Singer is a journalist and the author of the award-winning book, There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. She's an expert in safe systems, injury prevention, and harm reduction, and will be the keynote speaker at the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Given those numbers I just gave, accidental deaths, a top cause of death in the United States, I feel like we don't think of them as a category. We don't have awareness campaigns for this as a whole. Why don't we pay more attention to this in general?
You know, I think that this idea of the accident is incredibly intoxicating. And in my research, I found again and again this deep-seated desire that we all had to sort of brush off this massive category of harm. And just to be clear, what we're talking about here is unintentional injury. And that includes everything from traffic crashes to fires to falls to drownings to drug poisonings, a massive category of harm. But all these things that we like to just pretend are the product of individual mistakes, that someone screwed up and therefore the worst happened. But if you actually track back these incidences, track them through history, and track individual deaths today, you find a story that there's nothing random here. And rather, actually, what we call accidental death is predictable, preventable, and not at all random. And, you know, there are a lot of ways that this might, you know, jar people. People might be saying, wait, no. I saw that traffic crash on the highway. That there's no way that was anything more than an accident. But while there are a lot of ways in all of these individual categories to explain how these events are predictable and preventable and built into the landscape we live in, the simplest way to look at the big picture is this. This is a uniquely American problem. Among wealthy nations, we die by accident at a much higher rate. So that's one way you could prove that this is absolutely not random. But here's another. It didn't used to happen here. The death rate by accident in this country fell for decades before this most recent rise, and those deaths have been rising since 1992. Now, Europeans aren't more careful people. Conditions are different in Europe. We in America didn't get more accident prone. Conditions changed here. And I look this up in case some of your listeners don't believe me. Wisconsin has a higher rate of accidental death than every adjacent state, higher than Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota. So I would ask your listeners, are you clumsier in Wisconsin? Are you more accident prone? No, conditions are different. Conditions are different in different states, in different economies, in different cities and counties, and we see different rates of death. For all these things, we chalk up to randomness.
And a lot of the safety experts you talk to, and I've heard this from traffic people here in Wisconsin, steering clear of the word accident in the first place. Why is that?
Well, I think it's exactly for the same reason that we don't correlate all of these unintentional injuries. Because calling something an accident means that it was random and unpreventable, and it gives us a way to gloss it over, to individualize it, to make it about one human error as the problem, rather than the systemic design of our roads, of our workplaces, of our homes, how these things are built into the environment. And it's comforting to call something an accident. It makes us feel better, but it all but guarantees that the same so-called accidents happen the same way again and again and again.
Sadly, one story that you used to illustrate this throughout your book was a very personal one for you. A beloved friend killed in a traffic, what we might call accident, if we didn't think more about it. Can you share, if you're able, his story a little bit and the wider story behind it?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, yes, the New York Times called my best friend's death an accident. And that story starts in 2006. Eric Ng was my best friend. He was 22 years old. He was wonderful. A New York City high school math teacher. The sweetest, funniest guy. And he was riding his bike on a separate bike path that runs along the west side of Manhattan in New York City, where we live. And he was killed by a drunk driver who had mistakenly turned and entered this bike path. Now, that guy was drunk and speeding, and he went to prison. And for a long time, that was the end of the story. It was an accident. There was a drunk driver. But then 11 years later, a different man rented a truck, and he followed the exact same route as my best friend's killer. Except this second man, he intentionally turned onto this bike path. Now, this is the most heavily trafficked bike path in America. And he killed 8 people and severely injured 11 in an act of vehicular terrorism. And I remember being so shocked that someone had died in the exact same way, in the exact same place. And that the only thing that was different was the intention. One was an accident and one was a terrorist attack, right? And so I started to look into it, and I learned that the place where my best friend was killed had been the site of death for other people before and after Eric, on the same path. Now, every time, the drivers were different. You know, some were distracted, some were lost, some were drunk. And every time, the story that was told was it was an accident. And so no problems were solved. It was chalked up to human error. And the fact that this bike path was inherently a high-risk place, that it looked just like the road next to it, that there was nothing blocking drivers from entering it, like, allowed this harm to happen again and again and again. Now, after the terrorist attack, the city made the harm impossible. They put up a bollard at every single entrance to this bike path. So you could still go on there with a bike, but you couldn't drive your car down it anymore. And for me, it was this realization that accident was this magic word of willful ignorance, you know, that we use to be okay with preventable harm, that we individualized these people dying and the problem every time, a sort of magical thinking. And then we let people die until it stopped being an accident, you know. All of those deaths could have been prevented if we treated these accidents as systemic problems, problems of design, problems of the conditions and the environments that we face.
We're talking to Jesse Singer, author of the book, There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Another story you tell in the book, Jesse, is that the rise of the use of the word accident wasn't really an accident. There were motivations, often corporate and business motivations, over the years to ascribe things to personal failings. Can you start with the story of what we now call jaywalking and how pedestrians became, instead of the victims of a problem, the causes of their own problems?
This is a fascinating story. It occurs in a time as the automobile is becoming more popularized. And as a result, traffic fatalities are rising. More people own cars, and in cities, more people are getting struck and hit by cars. And this is a big problem for automakers, because people's reaction to these early traffic deaths are that cars are inherently dangerous. And they start to protest the idea that cars are even allowed in cities. Now, a little bit of language here. So jaywalker is a portmanteau. Jay is like an old-timey word for hillbilly. So a jaywalker is like a country bumpkin who doesn't know how to operate on city streets. And so before the 1920s, there was no such thing as a jaywalker. People walked in the street all the time, and that was just the norm. But today, in every state in the nation, it's the law that if a car strikes a jaywalking person, the person walking is at fault. And this is actually a transformation that took a concerted effort by automakers, because to sell cars, they had to make the car not the villain of the traffic crash. And so in these cases where a person walking was hit, they tried to villainize the jaywalker. They popularized the term, buying newspaper ads so it would appear in the press, creating news services that cataloged traffic accidents that always seemed to blame the jaywalker. They even bought signs for cities that read jaywalking prohibited, even though it wasn't a law anywhere yet. Now, obviously this was massively successful. Today we all think of jaywalking as wrong and bad. And if you get hit by a car in the street, it's your fault. And not the fact that cars are inherently dangerous machines to have in pedestrian-dense cities. Now, if folks want to read more about that, there's an excellent history of it in Peter Norton's Fighting Traffic. But the whole story is a great example of how intoxicating it can be to blame human error, to individualize these problems, and how easily we are distracted from inherently dangerous conditions, like big cars on city streets. And how drawing a focus on human error and individualizing these problems can serve private interests. It can sell cars. It can let factory owners maintain dangerous workplaces. It can distract us all from the fact that we do have systems in place that could protect us, but that it's profitable for corporations for us not to be protected.
Jesse Singer is with us, author of the book, There Are No Accidents. She'll be in Wisconsin next month to give the keynote talk, the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or thoughts about how to make roads, workplaces, or healthcare systems more safe? Have you ever been harmed by a mistake that someone else made? Did you think it was their fault, or was there something else more fundamental that made the condition unsafe in the first place? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with journalist Jesse Singer about her book, There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. Jesse will give the keynote address at the Wisconsin Healthy Community Summit on April 29th. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how to rethink the causes of accidents, unintentional injuries, the third leading cause of death in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Terry is with us in Winnebago County. Terry, hi.
Hi. I would like to comment on an early comment that your guest made about Wisconsin having more accidents than all of the states around us. And if I remember correctly, I think the last time I saw a study about alcohol consumption, different communities in Wisconsin were like 6 or 7 of the top 10. And I would submit that alcohol consumption is a large part of this problem of accidents.
Terry, thanks for the call. And Jesse, that's what popped into my head too. There is data on drinking and driving in Wisconsin, alcohol-related falls in Wisconsin causing problems. If we were to approach this in the way that you're talking about in the book, as opposed to or in addition to, you know, ticketing people for drunk driving, things like that, what might be a systemic approach to try to tackle a problem like that?
This is such a good question, because I think drinking especially gets at this urge for us to blame individuals. Now, I looked into the numbers coming on because I was surprised to see how much worse things were in Wisconsin, the neighboring states. And it seems the vast majority of your higher rates of accidental deaths come from falls. And I think you're right. A lot of those could be alcohol related. They could be weather related. They could be weather plus alcohol related. But the question is, right, well, what do you do about people getting drunk and falling, and also older population related, all of those things combined? And, you know, you could tell people not to drink. You could fine people for not drinking, but I think anyone who knows anyone who drinks knows that that's not going to work. And so I'm going to cite, I'm going to quote a safety expert who's in my book, and she told me, this is one of the people who pioneered the child car seat. She created the injury severity score. Dr. Susan P. Baker, she's a famous epidemiologist. And she said her most controversial opinion was this: we need to make the world safe for drunks. Because if we make the world safe for drunks, we make it safe for people who are sleepy, for moms who are distracted by children in the back seat, for people who are worried about a conversation with their boss later. And what that means, making the world safe for drunks, is making the world safe for imperfect people. Now, how does that relate to drinking? One way is building regulations, ADA accessibility, the sort of things that make spaces more navigable for people who don't have their full abilities would definitely make things safer for people who are drunk. snow and ice clearing regulations that make sure people have safe paths between places. Another thing that occurs is, you know, looking at drinking and social programs with transportation. You know, there's really good evidence from Washington, D.C., that providing public transportation directly reduces DUIs. So all of these things can affect how being drunk might cause harm. And I think that's the key way to look at it. We want to reduce the harm of drinking. And the harm isn't the drinking in this case. The harm is the falling while drunk, right? So if we want to do that, all we need to do is put sort of pillows, figurative ones, between us and our mistakes, between us and our falls. And this can occur on the state level, you know, when we're talking about building regulations, when we're talking about, you know, grab bars and cushioning blows and how we help people who have fallen get out of the hospital and still be able-bodied by keeping them exercising in the hospital. But we can also do this on the federal level. Like currently, the federal government, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, has no standard for a safe floor. Like those words mean nothing. There's no such thing as an official, safe, non-slip floor. And so when people are building senior homes and hospitals and even bars, you know, places where people are more likely to slip, there's no tested form to prove that a floor is less likely to let you slip. Now, the federal government could be regulating that. They could be creating a standard for a safe floor. So places that have more of a fall risk could be making their environment safer and just assuming that people are going to get drunk and that our goal, instead of trying to police behavior, which we know doesn't work, could be reducing the likelihood that that behavior is going to cause harm.
Thanks for that call, Terry. Talking to Jesse Singer, author of the book, There Are No Accidents. Jesse, I think we might all think, hey, an accident, it could happen to any of us at any time. Another key point in your book is there are some people in our country who are more vulnerable to accidents based on income and race and other conditions. How does this affect us differently?
This is very true, and this is very important, especially for people who are still on the, you know, listening in and saying, what? Accidents are random. Accidents are unpredictable. If accidents are random, then injury-related death would fall randomly across the country. It does not. People living in poverty and people of color are more likely to die by accident. And this is especially true for accidents where policy and infrastructure make the difference between life and death. Safety of our homes, our roads, our workplaces. To name a few examples, just to show you how stark the numbers are. Black people are more than twice as likely to die in a house fire as white people. Indigenous people are more than twice as likely to be struck and killed by drivers as white people. People living in West Virginia, which is a relatively poor state, are more than twice as likely to die by accident than people just across the state line living in Virginia, just a few miles away. A way to understand this is that policy decisions lead to risk unequally distributed across the U.S. And so while we often think of accidents as a matter of personal responsibility, they're actually a matter of risk exposure, and we're not all exposed to the same risk.
What can we do about this? You give a number of possible policy changes toward the end of your book. A lot of them might take years of effort to get there. What do you see as low-hanging fruit that can make a big difference in a fairly short time horizon?
Picture, this is a regulatory problem that needs a regulatory solution. And I hear you, that is big and long, but I don't think anyone should stop talking to their elected officials on the federal level about the need to regulate, about the power of regulations, because we see it across the board. Workplaces that face OSHA inspections, workers are less likely to die there. It's true of when NHTSA regulates cars and so on and so forth. But when it comes down to it, there's so much you can be doing locally. There are a million ways to prevent accidental death. So in your community, looking at traffic calming, speed governors on city-owned vehicles, public transit expansions are all going to reduce the likelihood of traffic fatalities. Opening safe injection sites and giving free naloxone to everyone in your community is going to reduce the likelihood that anyone dies from taking too much drugs. Incorporating ADA accessibility and strict building regulations that are enforced, like ramps and grab bars, are going to reduce the likelihood that a fall is a death sentence. Fire safety regulations, like sprinklers and self-closing doors, are the difference between a fire and a deadly fire. There are 10,000 little answers. And I think at the core of them, I would ask you to remember what Dr. Baker said. Making the world safe for drunks. Every time you see or hear about an accident, say like, how could this environment be safe for a drunk person? And say it without judgment. Don't worry about the behavior. Focus on putting a pillow between us and our mistakes and our bad decisions. Look for ways to turn away from personal responsibility and individual blame and towards systemic protections that reduce harm for everyone, even when we screw up.
As I mentioned, you're presenting at the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. Do you sense a hunger from local communities to start making these kind of changes just in our last minute or so?
I think absolutely. I think people are tired of hearing about things that are chalked up to accidents. I think more and more people are questioning this idea. I mean, if you look at the recent Boeing crashes, the Norfolk Southern train derailment, more and more communities are affected by these so-called accidental disasters, are seeing these one-off accidents in their communities and saying, if it keeps happening on the same street, is it really an accident? If the same people are always dying, is it really an accident? And why isn't my community seeing change? There are so many ways we can bring these changes locally to protect people, even when they make mistakes. And I think there's a real hunger to make those changes. And hopefully we can talk about that on April 29th and going forward.
Jesse, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
That's Jesse Singer, journalist, expert in safe systems, injury prevention, and harm reduction. We've been talking about her book. It's called There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. Jesse will be the keynote speaker at the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. You can learn more at wisconsinbikefed.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.